I can tell already by the nature of the feeling tone at each of your tables that this is going to be a very rich journey you're going to take over these coming 8 weeks. So I'm going to just try to give you a little bit more of some things to think about and explore and discuss. We're going to see one more brief segment from John Philip, but first I want to say something about the rocks. So take your rock in your hand, and this rock is, as I said, from Iona. One of the interesting things about Iona as pilgrimage site is it was not just an Iron Age fort and a druid center for burial, which in the Celtic druid world was a place that was a place you could connect into the other world, where the veils are thin. And later is it became the center, a major school for many centuries from the time St. Columba came from Ireland in 563 and formed his monastic school and order there into the 12th century. It was the central place that was like the seed of the Celtic Christian Church, which had had many input from other places, but from Iona, Aidan went out, founded Lindisfarne, as many others went out, Lindisfarne into Europe, Europe into the Alps, the Spain, the Rhine, the founding seeding of the Rhine mystics, all the way into Ukraine, where there are 97 known Celtic Christian schools that were formed, that brought their own particular view and met with what was going on in the culture and of that time. But what makes it an interesting pilgrimage site as well is often when you are walking Iona, which is small, a mile and a half wide and 3 miles long, you will bump into groups of young students in their hiking boots and Gore-Tex jackets and hats like yours with the wind blowing, and they all are studying the rock. The rock is very old on Iona. It's one of the places on the planet that the rock has not been submerged by water. It is pre-creature. Some of the stones you are holding have been dated to 2.3 billion years old. Pre-creature. A lot of the stones, if you're walking with geologists and on the island and put a compass down, they show true north is south. The stones that are there, many of them, that you're holding, their magnetic pole, they existed before the last magnetic shift of the poles. And why is this stone so important? There's something about what draws people to this island other than just the history, the human history. There's something of the earth history that is there as well. The earth history mystery. And in some ways, these stones are like reminders of the seed of the planet. They are rock seeds. They remind us of something about the origins of this world. And if we take what John Philip is saying deeply within ourselves as God in all life, there is born within this planet a seed destiny that is of God, all life forms, all life expressions. And we are a much later unfoldment of an incarnation of God. The memory of what stirs sometimes when we touch these ancient places, and just to give you another visual, in the formation of the earth at that time, why they say Iona remained above water is actually in one of the, across on the Isle of Mull, there's an old volcano, very similar to Haleakala on Maui, formation. So there's a lot of volcanic activity. And they know that Iona is a different continent than the rest of Britain, which is fascinating because you can see the continent across the sound, across the water, which is just a short boat, 10-minute ferry ride across. But part of what happened is the earth tipped up at an angle. So when you walk on Iona, you're walking on the layers of history, which is fascinating. And if you all sort of look at each other's stones, you see great diversity in them. Some of them are white and have a bit of green in them. Iona stone has been used for quite a while as the marble, well sought after for building altar stones throughout Britain and Europe. Westminster Abbey's altar is formed of Iona marble. It's the only place that has this particular marble. And you can actually go down into the ruins of where the remnants of the quarry, they finally, I think in 1920 or so, stopped getting the marble. But again, that's a mystery. Why are people drawn to this ancient, ancient stone as the altar for these churches at the heart of our Christian worship? So, not that I have the time to go into this any further, but there is something about the remembrance, and it's a metaphor. These rocks are metaphors of the ancient seed planted within us. And if any of you know about seeds, and I've talked about this when I've spoken at Word and Life before, if you take the acorn that becomes the oak, at the heart of the acorn, you open it up to the very center, that genetic seed pattern that holds the full potential of that oak tree through every stage of its development until its maturity, is held in an invisible core that cannot be dissected or seen. Our seed nature exists in pure essence, pure spirit. Within ourselves, our core, this place that John Phillips saying, which resides within us each, is not of substance. It's of no thingness. It is pure essence. But within that core seed essence is the fullness of all the potentiality, if we're but given the nourishment at each stage of our life to begin to unfold, unfurl, and blossom. And to me, that is so astounding. I mean, and it's such a metaphor for the spiritual life and where Christ points us. And some say that that core essence can be touched within the heart, you know, within the heart of silence, the beautiful practice of centering prayer that leads us into that inner room, that inner chamber where we meet the pure essence of God. And I'm getting carried away. on rocks and seeds, but the metaphor of the rock, the metaphor of what lies within our own being. And Iona too is a metaphor. An island, ancient, a place set apart. You journey to it. The veils are thin between this world and the other. These are the things said of Iona. It is a place of time eternal, of Chronos time, of circular time, not of historical or of the time that is the clock of our everyday. It is a place beyond our role in the world. We touch our soul. And each of us have those places that are like Iona, whether they are in our practices or in the Sierras, or as you were saying, where you go and find those magnificent agate rocks. We each have our place, our journey that takes us to those mysterious, magical places where we remember, in essence, something about the love that we were created in. So I wanted to say that about the rock, and I know we have limited time. As we go back to consider the church, I think what was planted within our organizations, our churches, our human communities also carry these seeds of possibility and potential, not just in a tree or a flower. So going in and listening, what does the church call forth? What is at the essence? There we can be informed as to the next stage of what is ours to do. That's a part about bringing that about. So that gift and act of listening is really important. And to just bring this back to something that John Philip Newell will speak about here in this next segment, it has to do with this essence and trusting that that essence is within each of us to ascertain, to discover, to listen to open ourselves to make room and space for. So do you want to do that next section? Not the one on the...
What about the first thing, you can't go back once you start it?
No, just the 2301.
2301, okay.
And tonight I want to look at one of the yearnings, one of the features of this rebirthing that is characteristic of or touches on or informs nearly every other aspect of the rebirthing. And that is the desire to come back into relationship with the sacredness of the earth. Or as Thomas Berry, our great eco-theologian in the Christian household, said, we need to move from a spirituality of alienation from the natural world to a spirituality of intimacy with the natural world. One of the features of this rebirthing that is stirring is the desire to come back into relationship with the true heart of everything that has being, in this recognition that everything has come forth from the womb of the One. John the Beloved begins his prologue to the Gospel of John by saying, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And then he goes on to say, and all things have come into being through the Word. Which is to say that everything is essentially an expression, a living expression of the One. Or as some of our later teachers in the Celtic tradition put it, in the beginning was the sound. And the sound was with God, and the sound. was God. Everything is essentially a sounding of the sacred presence, a vibration. And if somehow that sound or that vibration were extracted from the universe, everything would cease to exist. So this sounding is not simply a dimension of life, it is the very essence of life. It is the very essence of our being. And it's that essence that we are being invited to allow to come forth again in radically new ways. New science now speaks about the sound of the beginning as something that can be detected throughout the entire universe. It is everywhere. It's even within the apparent solidity of rock formations, that vibration of the first sound. And that sound has been identified as a B flat, way down. Now, not to be too boastful about these matters, but the Scottish bagpipes are tuned to the B flat. Now, one wonders what the outcome of the recent referendum in Scotland about independence would have been if the Scottish nationalists had made more of this point. But there is this wonderful convergence that we are living in the midst of, between many of the awarenesses of new science and many of the ancient awarenesses of the great spiritual traditions of humanity, because all of them in their different ways have been saying, in the beginning was the sound. In the beginning was Om. In the beginning was the word. In the beginning was the vibration.
So this is something to also explore. Again, time doesn't allow us to discuss this point, so we will go on. But I do want to say something just briefly about that essential vibration. And we'll come back to it again. Because we always think, well, how is that moving into a universe and world that's so divided? How can you, who believes this way, that's so the antithesis of life-giving, loving life, however we judge or fragment or break up and analyze and segment, you know, how can you be an expression of that vibration? And I think it is very important to recognize that while our life gives us a journey through the struggle of emergence of that vibration, that we need to always tend to that listening and that seeing of the other, whether it is in nature, which is part of the Findhorn community experience. We're not looking at the rose or the watermelon or the sweet pea. We're looking at the essence of that, or to one another. I'm not looking at you in terms of your hairstyle or your clothing or what you did yesterday or what you said, but I'm looking at your essence of what is seeking to be expressed, of what is yearning to come forth. And we have a responsibility not only for that listening within ourselves, but that way of beholding and seeing of one another and calling that forth. And we'll go to the next section and continuing.
Given the love of John, John, this one whom in the Celtic world is usually just referred to as John the Beloved or John of Love, I have given quite a bit of time over the last 10 years to delving further and further into John writings or writings associated with John and the community of John in Asia Minor, or legends and stories about John. We have only some of John's writings that made it into the canon of scripture as defined by the 4th century imperial council. We need to ask some questions about what was happening in the 4th century, because our Christianity had got into bed with empire. It was now the religion of empire. And we know the phrase, an inconvenient truth. And there were many inconvenient truths in our Christian household. And many of these were silenced by empire, so that our religion began to say what was convenient to the holders of power. I've often wondered, in what other area of life would we tolerate being told what to read by a 4th century council of men? And yet we have somewhat passively just read what they told us to read.
I love that, as, again, to be discussed in your future explorations of this rebirthing.
And the circle dance is the next episode.
Yeah, I think just given the time, I'm going to pass on that. Okay. Though I think this series, on which you can all get on YouTube, and in fact, is there a way for you to give the link to this to everybody?
You know, I'll put it on the website, but it's very easy. Just Google John Philip Newell Rebirthing, and you'll find it in YouTube. And it's an hour and 14 minutes. It's pretty long.
So did you all hear that? You can just YouTube this whole talk. It was given at All Saints in Pasadena.
I can send the link to all of you on my next reminder.
Yeah, and in fact, you know, it's a nice companion to the book, and I would encourage you. He brings in some things later that he would have liked to have added to the book. Another one we were going to play was his realization about birth and someone speaking about midwifing and the birth of rebirthing of God. And he had this wonderful insight and calls Allison his wife, John Philip's wife, and is sharing this insight. And she said, "Well, you know what this reminds me of is when I was in labor with our first child in the throes of giving birth, it dawned on me, there's no turning back." As if for the first time she got that. So he makes the analogy, we're at a point where we're beginning to realize, oh, there's no turning back here. We're in these throes and we're laboring to give birth. And very much, I think I'll just talk this next little bit. Very much the throes of what we are experiencing in our world is part of this rebirth. One of the things that's very important to consider is that in any transformation process, remember I spoke before the break about with birth comes death, it's precarious. With any change process, there's always that opportunity for miscarriage and for aborting the process. And part of it is our fear of the unknown, our fear of the natural stage of going through transformation is an entry into that liminal space, limen meaning the Latin word threshold, the in-between stage from here before I get there. Break down, break open, break through. we are terrified of the break open, and so we run from it. We, the chaos of it, the ambiguity, the fluid nature, where everything sort of feels like it's falling apart. It doesn't hold. And yet that's where incarnation takes place. That break open into that essential non-substance, no-thing, essential core place from which the next emanation of incarnation occurs. And until we befriend that space, and our practices, our contemplative practices, are there to help us learn to befriend, become familiar, become absolutely addicted to letting go, to surrendering, to opening, because we trust so deeply that therein God speaks, God lives, God moves. And there we are informed from how we go forward next. I think I want to just come back because of time to think about tomorrow and the inauguration. Because that essential place holds a quality of life, presence, and force that is so immense, is so vast, so intimate, that it embraces everything. And it reconciles everything. And it unifies everything. And very few roles in our life and in our vocations, our professions, actually draw on the capacity to be in that ambiguity, to be in that place that would open our experience to be able to hold the tension that comes when you are holding a field, a presence, a godness that can hold the totality. And yet that's what we need in order for the birth to take place. We need midwives. I was going to say midwifery is one of those professions that the tending to the birth through all of the drama, all of what's going on. If you ever attend a birth, and I've been lucky to attend five, the midwife will sit back and do nothing but watch, witness, wait until an action is needed, steps forward, breathe here, water here, push here, withdraw, wait, watch, but with 100% focus and attention. And I've talked to midwives. They're holding this field, aware of everything that's going on and what is called for in action to help that birth take place. It's a little bit of a stretch, but in a sense, that's what we're needing to do for our world right now and for our nation, for the presidency. It's not the man necessarily with the outer personality and persona and all the drama and the media and all this. It's what is happening in the essence. What is coming through this experience for our nation? I'll share this with you. On the election day, me and my mother, of course, Hillary supporters all the way, my mother just like, I've lived for this day. I woke up before voting started, about 4 a.m. And I went and felt compelled to just sit and be quiet and listen. And I was stunned to hear a voice say, the person who will grow the greatest number of people will become your next president. the person who will grow the greatest number of people will become your next president. And I thought, yay, of course it's Hillary. And as the day went on, this voice kept echoing, what does this mean? And so when the outcome came, I had to step to that deeper place in myself. Not of reaction, of polarization, of my belief versus others' belief. I had to go to that deeper place and listen to what was happening in the spirit body of our country. The yearning for this next period of time of maturing and growth. And perhaps I needed to open myself to a consideration that I, in my outer form, did not know or understand what that was going to take, what that was going to call forth. So I use this as sort of a closing as we consider the rebirthing of God to getting to that deeper place of what is going to grow the church, not from the outer structures and forms that we've been attaching ourselves to and, you know, holding firm that, oh, well, you can only, you know, if someone, I don't know what those might be, but I mean, you can only go to heaven through Jesus. You know, I'm just pulling that. We need to look at and evaluate all of those things that we have taken on as being absolute and go deeper into what, as John Philip is saying, what's behind that, what's within it, what's emergent at the core. And then in that listening, in that discerning, finding that field of presence that is so immense that it holds the totality. And in holding that field of right and left, like Rumi says, there is a field beyond right and wrong. I will meet you there. That there, if we can but hold it, and it's a place of holding the tension. It's not easy. Because death and birth are right there in the process for what is seeking to come forward. And it's not splitting off between this is too uncomfortable, I don't want to do it, I just want to focus on what's next, I don't like looking at what's just happened. What I wanted to say about that transformational process is what happens in the liminal space is integration. The rebirthing of the church is going to take some deep work of integration. What have we lived through? What have we learned? What have we done in a way that is wonderful? What are the shadow things that we need to come to terms with? That's part of the work of transformation and of birthing. And again, when you're gestating that little baby is pulling from its genetic code. It's pulling from its ancestry as it also is seeking to incarnate something totally unique and new. There is a profound tension between the two. When that field of the womb of God, as John Philip says, can hold that tension, and then we can midwife a mystery into our world. And so as you all continue to explore, I'd just like to leave you with that thought of you being a collective midwife here, of you being a collective midwife for an emergent understanding, an emergent revelation. And it's happening here. Each one of you carries a piece. And coming again back to the Celtic, and I know we're going over just 1 minute, it's 12 o'clock, but I love this about the Celtic, early Celtic Christian school, which I've learned about, is all those early Celtic monks and women who also were part of these schools of learning, there was a concept that each one of us is a journeyer. And if we pay attention to our own life journey, we each discover an aspect of the creation that is ours to bring back and to tell and share. And it is through our honoring our own life experience and coming and bringing that out that we are bringing forth the next iteration of the creation story, of God's story. And it's a beautiful image because we each have journeyed. And so as you further together really pay attention to your dreams over this next few months, to the inspirations, to the phrases that come to you, and here's a place for you to share and weave those pieces together, and I have a feeling you're going to come up with some good revelatory insight as to this rebirthing of God. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Catherine. Catherine has given us so many things to think about. So our next meeting of the midwives next Thursday at 10 o'clock, Richards Grove. See you then. Thank you. Mid-husbands, okay. Midwifery, mishusbandry.